Green Bay, Hello, Madison. What's going on over there? Election day, very exciting. Okay, we're so glad to have Tim Nettleshine here from Reinhart. He's going to talk about these LLC and tax issues and partnership issues as they relate to bankruptcy. And this is a topic that's been very hot on the listserv. And Todd was telling me it's something they've discussed at their office trying to figure out some of these issues. So we're really looking forward to that. Next month, we've got a legal research topic, and we've got a couple of the law clerks and our librarian, Barbara, from upstairs, is going to come down and talk about what's new, what are the best, most effective ways to do legal research in the bankruptcy area. So please come on back for that. And Todd and I just came up with our topic for October, and that is going to be this issue of a creditor who forecloses, but then stops short of taking the property all the way back, or selling the property. So now the debtor is stuck with it and running up liabilities for taxes and for code violations and things like that. Todd and I are going to take the lead to bring some of the cases and some of the ideas from other jurisdictions and some of the ideas we have, but we really hope that this is a very interactive discussion. And that folks will come with, hey, how about this? No, I thought about that. That won't work because. I was just in Santa Fe at judicial education, and I learned what they're doing in Florida about this. And, of course, Florida's a big foreclosure nightmare state. So I can tell you what they said. I'm not sure it works here, but that's going to be for October. If you would like to join Todd and I on the panel, please, we'd love to have you, Olivier. And we just welcome everybody to come with your ideas. It's such a problem. It's something I really want to tackle because I feel so bad, and it's not only hurting the debtors, it's hurting the neighbors, it's hurting the community. So I really want to tackle this. That's going to be in October. Looking for a speaker for November, and I think we'll have Jack back in December for our ethics credit, always timely for those reporting. So without further ado, thank you again to Tim Nettleshine, who's going to talk to us about tax and LLCs and partnerships and bankruptcy.
Thank you, Judge. Well, this area is confusing, so let's try to struggle through it here. Let me just talk about some basic concepts to help you understand why it's confusing. We're talking about partnerships and LLCs, which are the same for tax purposes. An LLC is a partnership, so it's, when I say partnership, I mean LLC. When I say LLC, I mean partnership. Doesn't make any difference for purposes of the analysis. The other problem is that in partnership tax law, which is, you know, governs most of this, there's an eternal war, if you will, about whether you make various tax determinations at the partner level, that's called the aggregate theory, or you make them at the partnership level, that's called the entity theory. And you would think that it's one or the other, and the reality is not. It's sometimes one and it's sometimes the other, and that's an advantage for you as lawyers to the extent you want to argue that it's at the partner level, because you get an exception like the bankruptcy exception under Section 108. You can do that. You can say, well, the aggregate theory should apply here. So you just have to remember that. The other thing to remember here pertains to real estate and how you look at debt discharge that occurs in connection with the sale of real estate. You know, you have, in my example, I think I have a piece of real estate with debt of $2 million. It's only worth $1 million, so it's $1 million underwater. And the basis in the real estate in the LLC is $500,000. So normally you would say, well, you know, if you sell the real estate for $1 million, you have basis of $500,000, you have $500,000 a gain. And the excess of that is debt discharge income, which is what you want, because if you qualify under one of the Section 108 exceptions, that debt discharge income is tax-free. You know, so that's what you want to have if you're representing a debtor. The problem is that there's a case out there many years ago when I was in law school, actually. It's called Tufts versus Commissioner. And then there's a regulation that's cited in my materials. It's 1.1001. of the regulations for the IRS, they say that if the debt in this example is non-recourse, then there is no debt discharge income. The sale price is the debt. So now you have $2 million of sales proceeds, if you will, and $500,000 of basis and $1.5 million of gain. So you get a tremendously worse result for whoever is taxed with respect to this transaction if it's non-recourse. And you have to understand that fundamental difference. And you know, in its day, real estate at the partnership level was often completely non-recourse. But it's not always so. You often see partnership guarantees, and you can also see that the debt might be recourse to the LLC itself. But there is this distinction. Now, the case law, I think, says that you determine this issue of recourse versus non-recourse at the partner level. All right? But if you read the regulations and you read the code, 1001, it doesn't really tell you that, all right? And I think you want to argue that it's at the partner level because you want it to be recourse to avoid this big gain number, because if there's gain, there's no escaping it other than hoping that the bankruptcy estate owns the LLC interest when the gain is realized. So there's no escaping it other than having somebody else hold the hot potato when the gain happens. And by the way, if there's questions, just go ahead and ask. Interrupt me while we're going on. I don't want to impede discussion. So understand that problem. There's this case, I didn't cite it in my materials. It's called Great Plains Gasification. For those of you who want to write stuff down, it's 92 TCM, that's capital T, capital C, capital M, 534. And that case just stands for the proposition that the issue of whether you have recourse or non-recourse debt with respect to a real estate transaction is determined at the partner level, not the partnership level. Okay? All right, so with that kind of preamble, let's just kind of go through the materials, and if you have questions, please ask them.
Hey, Tim.
Yes?
Just back up a bit for those of us that don't have the same background. Can you just walk through the rest of your hypothetical and show us what the impact would be on the debtor who's in this scenario? You said, okay, there would be tax consequences or there would be, in a non-recourse situation, we don't want that. Can you just kind of take the hypothetical the rest of the way and explain to us?
Yeah,
what
let's
happens?
Just go through 1A. I think
okay.
1 through 7 has each of those points touched on. So here we have the debtors in bankruptcy, and the LLC is not, for whatever reason. Just as a kind of a planning point, you know, if I controlled an LLC and I was going through bankruptcy, I probably want to put the LLC in bankruptcy too, because it may help eliminate questions of the applicability of the bankruptcy exception under Section 108. Okay? All right, so we've got this real estate worth $1 million. The debt is $2 million. The basis in the partnership for the real estate is $500,000. So, and the basis of the LLC interest itself is also $500,000. So there's two different basis issues. One is the LLC interest, and one is the real estate itself. And they just happen to equal each other here. In most cases, they wouldn't. And after I wrote this, I realized, geez, I should have had a different number, but. So that's what I have. And our debtor owns 51% in this case. And I only did that because when the gain is allocated, they're going to get 51% of the gain. All right, so what happens in this situation? The debtor files for bankruptcy. The LLC is not. They file. The LLC interest becomes property of the bankruptcy estate. All right? That's a good thing. All right? Because the LLC interest, as I said, is a hot potato, and it's going to generate tax income. You want somebody else to own it than you, if you're the debtor. And so when you start the bankruptcy, it goes into the bankruptcy estate. That transfer into the bankruptcy estate is not a taxable disposition, doesn't have any tax consequences to the debtor at that point in time. Same thing when it comes back out on the backside, no tax consequences. So you now have this LLC interest sitting in the bankruptcy estate. What can happen? Well, the foreclosure could occur, or the property could be turned back or sold while the bankruptcy is pending, and you now have an income event. The real estate is gone. It's either been sold to somebody for $1 million, or it's been turned back to the bank, one or the other. Now, the tax consequences for that, whatever they might be, are now generated. If the real estate debt that's sitting in this LLC is non-recourse, all right, the purchase price is not the fair market value as you know it. That it's not common sense, but it's the way it is. I'm not going to go into the philosophical discussion of why that is, but the gain is $2 million. Basis is $500. $1.5 million of gain is now generated at this LLC, and it's going to flow through to somebody. And that somebody is whoever owns that LLC interest. So who owns it? Well, we filed bankruptcy. It's in the bankruptcy estate. So unless the bankruptcy estate abandons that LLC interest, that gain is going to flow through to the bankruptcy estate and not the debtor. And it's important to, if you didn't know it, there are separate taxable entities, the bankruptcy estate and the debtor. Okay, the partnership or the LLC is not separate, but the estate and the debtor are. Question?
If it was a practical matter, the trustee's going to abandon
it. Yeah, or they could.
The mortgage company is going to move to the automatic estate, so it's no longer going to be an asset of the estate, and now it's going to be the debtor's property.
I agree. The question is, well, Tim, you know, wake up, smell the coffee. Trustee's not stupid. They're going to abandon this. Yeah, I agree. They may abandon the asset. And the timing here is that they have to abandon the asset before the end of the partnership's taxable year in which the foreclosure occurs. All right? Which is after usually the foreclosure. I'm just trying to, so you get timing. So they can have the foreclosure occur in the bankruptcy, but before the end of the partnership taxable year, they abandon, now it comes back to you. All right? They can do that. And they are that by doing that, they are ridding themselves of these tax consequences. And the best you can do about that is want that not to be non-recourse debt. Why? It's going to be abandoned. The hot potato is going to move back to me, debtor. So I'm holding the hot potato. If it's recourse, the whole $2 million is taxable to me. I have nothing to say about it. It's all income. Okay, in this case, it'd be 51% of that, but it's going to generate all that income. If instead, let's say I guaranteed this debt, all right, and I can say, well, it was recourse. Well, in that case, we look at the true fair market value of the property. Here it's $1 million, right? I have $500,000 of basis. When they abandoned the property, the basis came back to me, right? So now I've got only $500,000 of gain, not a million and a half, right? And what happens to that extra million? Well, that's cancellation of debt income, all right? Now, there's a lot of controversy amongst bankruptcy tax wonks, I guess, about, I'll answer in a second, about, well, okay, the hot potato moved back to me, the debtor, but the debt discharge occurred, you know, if it occurred in the bank, at the partnership level, then the bankruptcy exception is not applicable. Well, here, if you abandon the property, it occurs at the partner level for sure, all right? And you're in bankruptcy, so that $1 million is tax-free. So moving the hot potato back to me actually is not the worst result. I end up with a little bit of gain, but a lot not. Now, if it were non-recourse, it would be a disaster.
Uh, you're assuming a gain of $1.5 million if it's non-recourse and a gain of $500,000 if it's recourse, doesn't it depend in both cases on what the bid is at the sheriff's sale?
The question is, you know, Tim, common sense. The sale price should be the bid at the sheriff's sale. And that is the normal rule if it's recourse debt. You're right. If it's recourse debt, it's the sheriff bid that's confirmed at the foreclosure sale. But if it's non-recourse debt, they ignore that. And that's the disaster, tax-wise, because it generates so much gain. I mean, and the philosophy here is that this partnership and all of its partners took deductions based on this non-recourse debt for years, probably, and all you're doing is recapturing them by getting them all of this gain. That's the theory. But no, you ignore the sheriff's sale, and that's the pitfall. And if they abandon the property, it comes back to you. So, perversely enough, it's better if you had a recourse debt than a non-recourse debt. All right? Now, as to abandonment, I mean, obviously, you don't want abandonment to occur if you represent the debtor, because you want this gain, whether it's $2 million or $500,000, to be taxable to the bankruptcy estate. And I just for what it's worth, the paragraph 3 there on the first page, there's some authority out there. I think it's goofy, but it's authority nonetheless, that says that an abandonment can trigger tax consequences to the bankruptcy estate. And if that's true, then you would say to the trustee, well, you're not going to escape anything. Don't abandon it. You know, do me a favor here. It's not burdensome to you in any way, shape, or form, because it's going to cause a tax consequence whether you abandon it or not. Now, personally, I think that's wrong. The wrong decision. I mean, the whole idea of Section 1398, which is the kind of the code section that governs transfers of property from the debtor to the bankruptcy estate and then back out, 1398 clearly says that when it goes in at the beginning of the bankruptcy and when it comes out at the end, it's clearly a non-taxable disposition. There is no 752 income that I talk about in paragraph 3 there. These cases are talking about what I would call a midstream abandonment. It happened before the end of the bankruptcy estate. If the trustee were thinking about it, they would think to themselves, well, I'd rather do this at the end of the bankruptcy estate as long as the partnership's tax year hasn't closed yet. Even if the foreclosure has occurred, then they would get exactly the result they want. The hot potato moves back to the debtor. Partnership year closes while the debtor owns the hot potato, even though it's after the foreclosure, and all the tax consequences flow through to the debtor. But in this case, that didn't happen, and so for whatever reason, they wanted to do a midstream abandonment. But there's cases for, and I think there's a private letter ruling against, that's basically saying, hey, the 1398 provisions that say transfers in and out of the bankruptcy estate at the beginning and the end should apply to a midstream abandonment. So that's the only argument I think you can make on an abandonment issue. Question?
If the real estate's abandoned, the debtor receives his discharge, he now no longer has any obligation pursuant to his personal guarantee, which created the recourse. So he's discharged that liability. Does that make a difference? Now the sale occurs?
You mean after?
Is it still recourse?
Well, it was recourse when it was created.
So that's all.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. I mean, I think the issue of this whole partnership versus partner liability is often you have the liability at the partnership level, the debt discharge occurs up there, and the partner guaranteed it and got the discharge in a bankruptcy perhaps that preceded the foreclosure. That's really the problem. You know, you went through your bankruptcy, you flushed everything out, you discharged your personal liability and your guarantee, and then after your bankruptcy was concluded, this foreclosure occurred at the partnership level, which you didn't control. And let's say it was recourse. So part of it, a big part of it, in this case $1 million, is cancellation of debt income. and you're not in bankruptcy anymore. And I would argue that even though that's what's occurred, your debt liability was discharged in a bankruptcy. And Section 108D6 says, just kind of, you know, throw off one line sentence, you know, you determine the exception for bankruptcy at the partner level. Well, you can run with that as far as you want. You say, well, if we're going to term it at the partner level, even though the cancellation of debtedness is triggered at the partnership level, it says you determine my exception at the partner level. That means even though my bankruptcy preceded the income event, it should be tax-free. That's what I would argue if I had that problem. So any other questions on that? All right, so let's go on. We talked about if the mortgage debt was recourse, then you have the gain that's less. Get some revenue rulings for that proposition. You're generating debt discharge income, which hopefully is going to be tax-free because the debtor is either insolvent or in bankruptcy, his or herself. Then the Tufts case I cite there in paragraph 5. Then paragraph 6, just the whole proposition of who owns the hot potato. If the bankruptcy estate owns the hot potato, when the taxable year of the partnership in which the foreclosure occur ends, they have to have the income. Now let's assume the partnership LLC is in bankruptcy, but the member is not. All right. What happens in that situation? Well, there's no separate taxable entity created for the partnership by reason of its bankruptcy, like there would be if the debtor filed bankruptcy. So it's basically a normal partnership tax question. If the mortgage debt is non-recourse, then you're going to have this big gain of $2 million. It's going to flow through to your non-bankruptcy debtor. They're going to have all this income. If it's recourse, then you're going to have this bifurcated analysis where part of the debt, in this case, $1 million, is cancellation of indebtedness, and part is gain, $500,000. Problem, of course, is the debtor is not in bankruptcy when this happens. The partnership is. Then you would say, well, I have cancellation of indebtedness income under Section 108. It's allocated to me under the partnership or LLC. Is that exempt or not? I'm not in bankruptcy. There's a case. I didn't cite it in my materials, but I will give it to you. There's a case called Gracia. That's TC Memo 2004-140-147. And then there's a companion case called Price 2004-149. Decided at the same time, pretty much, by the tax court, where they basically, you know, let the bankruptcy of the LLC or partnership qualify the debtor for the bankruptcy exception under Section 108. So Garcia and Price. Those would be good cases for you if you happen to represent somebody who's not in bankruptcy, but a LLC is in bankruptcy. Now, there's a case that's contra to that. It's called Yamamoto, and that's TC Memo 1990-549. So, you know, you would think the tax court would be the same, but there's actually a whole bunch of different tax court judges, and they have different philosophies on how this stuff is treated. So
even if this partner is not insolvent, the first two you cited are for the proposition that they could take the bankruptcy exception to the recognition of the cancellation of debt income,
right?
Even if they're not insolvent.
Right. Yeah, because I think one of them was the general partner who got that treatment, and the other was a limited partner. Now, you know, how I read the case, I mean, it's a tortured analysis. You know, I'm more of the opinion that 108, everything occurs at the partner level. the partner's in bankruptcy, no matter when the discharge occurs at the partnership level, you know, that's the attitude I would take. This took the other one, and the court agreed with that, and, you know, good for Price and good for Garcia. They escaped a significant income item.
Sometimes tax lawyers don't understand the bankruptcy law. Were these LLC cases Chapter 11 or Chapter 7? Because an LLC or another corporation doesn't get a discharge in a Chapter 7 case, only if it confirms a plan in an 11.
I don't recall, but I will say this about that. The question is, well, geez, Tim, in Chapter 7, an LLC or a partnership doesn't get a discharge. They do in an 11, apparently. I have to confess I didn't know that. But I don't think it makes any difference, because debt discharge, to me, is not necessarily dependent on some court saying I'm discharged.
But it is.
No, it's not.
Not
for tax purposes. Okay. I mean, if it's clear, let me just give look at our example. We have an asset here, one asset in the LLC, real estate. That's it. There's nothing else. It goes back to the bank or sold, whatever it is. There's no more money. And let's say it happens in a Chapter 7 of the LLC. No discharge granted, right? But there's nothing there. Clearly never going to be collected. The IRS says that's debt discharge. The debt is canceled because there's nothing there to be had. So it is, and I think I cite that in my material somewhere, page 2.
And you're talking about the debt discharge that creates the income. He's talking about the bankruptcy exception, where do you not need to get a bankruptcy discharge to get the bankruptcy?
No. Well, okay, the question is, do you or do you not need a bankruptcy discharge to get the Section 108 D1A bankruptcy exception? The answer is yes. Somewhere, somebody has to get discharged into bankruptcy. Yes, absolutely. And in my opinion, that has to be the partner, okay? But this Garcia case and this Price case also said, well, if the partner wasn't in bankruptcy and the partnership was, we'll let you get that exception too, all right?
Even if the entity doesn't get a discharge.
Right, so let's say the entity is in bankruptcy, but the debtor is not, all right? You know, common sense under 108 would say no exception, all right, because the debtor is not in bankruptcy. Price and Garcia would say, yeah, they do get it, all right? Let's say the debtor is in bankruptcy and the partnership is not, and that's really, I think, your hypothetical. In that case, the discharge never occurs at the partnership level. Debt discharge income is generated, just like I said, because there's no other assets. But clearly, under Section 108 D6 and 108 A1A, the bankruptcy exception applies. In my opinion, there's the committee reports, the Senate committee reports, legislative history to Section 108, you know, say that the bankruptcy exception applies if the partnership is in bankruptcy. I mean, if the partner's in bankruptcy and the partnership is not. I think somebody wrote me an email or something, maybe it was Todd, who said, geez, you know, if this discharge occurs at the LLC level and they're not in bankruptcy, how does the debtor get the benefit of 108? Because technically the discharge occurred up there. But legislative history, and I think the code itself really stands for the proposition that the debtors in bankruptcy, they can take advantage of that exception. So I don't know. Does that answer the question?
Well, so what you're saying is for tax purposes, a discharge of debt occurs when the debt is uncollectible, as opposed to being what we think of as a discharge.
Right. I mean, the problem here is that you really have opportunity for two different discharges occurring when you have an LLC or a partnership. You have the bank, the debtor, who puts something on a schedule, and then the court says it's discharged, right? I mean, that's clear what that is. That might be a guaranteed debt, that might be a direct debt, whatever it is. And then you have this, and this is the entity theory that I'm talking about when I'm talking about partnerships. You have the partnership itself that has a debt discharge event, whether that occurs because the bank forgives the debt or because the partnership is in bankruptcy and it's discharged in a Chapter 11, or if the discharge occurs under facts and circumstances because there's no assets. And you have this, you're going to have this potential for mismatch between when the debtor's in bankruptcy and when the partnership discharge occurs. And I'm just of the opinion that when you have that, if the partner goes through a bankruptcy, they get the benefit of that bankruptcy exception whenever that cancellation of debtor's income comes through.
Tim, is in your example, is the bank going to issue a 1099 when they liquidate the real estate and realize they're $1 million short?
Yeah, I mean, the question is what's the bank going to do from a compliance perspective? Are they going to give you that 1099? And the answer, I mean, sure, they probably are. And this is often a problem. I mean, just because they give you a 1099 doesn't mean it's taxable. All right? So, you know, of course, you have to justify the exception when you file your return. You know, whether I get a W, if I get a W-2 and it's not really income, I'll just not include it, but I'll probably put something on my 1040 that says why it's not taxable. Question?
So Tim, should we conclude that timing is not relevant? Because we often have, you know, the member or the partner coming in counseling with us, and they're saying, hey, I want to work a deal with the bank and do a short sale or cooperate with the bank, liquidate the asset, and then I'll come back and file bankruptcy later. Sometimes the bank is offering in that scenario to forgive the debt. There'll be some debt forgiveness as part of that workout ahead of the bankruptcy filing. And the question for us is, should we have them conclude that transaction with the bank before we file? Should we file before that transaction takes place, and then tell the partner, no, don't receive any kind of debt forgiveness from the bank as part of that transaction. We don't want that.
All right. So the question is, Tim, is timing relevant about when I orchestrate a foreclosure and bank release of debt? Can I do that before my client files bankruptcy? And my answer is the safest route is to do it in the bankruptcy. So there's no argument. All right? If the foreclosure occurs before the bankruptcy, you know, if the foreclosure occurs after the bankruptcy, I think you have arguments that you get the exception. But if it occurs before the bankruptcy, I think you got a problem. All right? Now, timing is only really an issue if it's recourse debt as to cancellation of indebtedness, because if it's non-recourse, there is no cancellation of indebtedness. So the bankruptcy exception is irrelevant. And the only thing that timing does for you for non-recourse debt transactions is hoping the bankruptcy estate owns the hot potato when the non-recourse foreclosure gain is realized in the taxable year of the LLC or partnership closes. The timing is only, and that timing is just a hope, because if the estate trustee, I suppose, is on his or her toes, they abandon it and you don't have a problem. Now, there is one thing I want to mention, and I said it in the materials, and I think it's pretty important. And this is the Section 506A of the Bankruptcy Code that has been used by debtors to say the Tufts non-recourse debt rule doesn't apply if the foreclosure occurs in a bankruptcy. So here, putting the partnership in a bankruptcy makes a difference. I think I cite that on page 2, paragraph 2, is a private letter ruling. So, I mean, if the debtor had property not in a partnership, 506A would apply if they were in bankruptcy, and then if the partnership was in bankruptcy and it had real estate, they would say 506A applies. And what 506A apparently says is that the secured debtor's claim is capped at the fair market value of the real estate. the court said, well, gee, if it's capped at the fair market value of the real estate, this whole Tufts argument about the sale price being the debt goes out the window. That's what you want. Because there's nothing you can do about non-recourse gain. It's all taxable. It's just a question of who owns the hot potato. If you can bifurcate the transaction and have half or part of it be cancellation of indebtedness and part be gain, then at least you have the opportunity to go through the Section 108 exceptions, you know, bankruptcy, insolvency, purchase price reduction, qualified business indebtedness, et cetera. So, did that answer the question? Okay. All right. So we covered the LLC in bankruptcy, and the debtor is not. I think that's pretty much all I've got, unless there are any other questions.
I wonder about, does it make sense to challenge the price at the foreclosure sale? If the bank is going to be buying in, which they often do, is it in the debtor's best interest to make sure that price is as high as possible so that the debt that's being forgiven above that price is as low as possible?
The question is, does it make sense to advocate for a higher price when the foreclosure occurs? And I think the answer is no. Unless there's going to be cash to use, excess cash. But if there's not going to be excess cash, the higher the price, the more the gain. Nobody escapes the gain. It's always taxable to somebody. It's just a question of who owns the hot potato. So the higher the price, the more the gain, somebody's going to get taxable. The lower the price, then at least you might have cancellation of debtor's income, and now we can go through 108 and say, well, bankruptcy exception, whatever, and I can have that. You'd really rather have it less.
You'd rather have the cancellation of debt income than just right. A straight capital gain.
Right. You'd always want the cancellation.
My other question is, so you get this bankruptcy or one of the other exceptions in 108, doesn't it come back to bite you if you end up being successful down the road? Because don't you have to take whatever you gained, if you will, and then reduce tax attributes down the road?
Well, I think you reduce the tax attributes for the assets you own at the time it happens. It doesn't grab. The question is doesn't cancellation and indebtedness hang over you forever until, even though you didn't have any income, you offset that cancellation of debtor's income against basis of whatever assets you might acquire for the rest of your life until you've absorbed this tax-free income? And I think the answer is no. It's the assets you have when it happens, not the assets you acquire later on. Question?
Does the bank have a reason, in your example, to report the $1 million loss so that, for example, they can write it off on the books and say, we took this back, we got $1 million at our sheriff's sale, or we credit bid it, now we have $1 million loss. So they have to, for example, issue a 1099 to write off their loss internally or otherwise?
And the question is does the bank have some regulatory or, you know, accounting, reporting incentive to issue a 1099 for the debt discharge income so they can write it off? And I would answer no. I mean, I'm on the board of a bank, and we wrote that off long before the debt discharge occurred. It's not related to whether I issue a 1099, is the short answer.
So they could just say, well, we took a $1 million loss and move on.
Right. I think what happens is that this is more of a compliance issue. They don't want to get a penalty for not issuing a 1099. I don't want to argue about it. So I see I have two choices. I can issue a 1099 and nobody can stop me and nothing bad happens to me other than somebody gives me a nasty phone call or email. Or I don't issue a 1099 and maybe the IRS, when they're auditing, when they're in here for 6 months and they figure this out and they say, oh, I don't like that. Here's a penalty and it's whatever it is. And you didn't do this in 100 pieces of real estate or 1,000 pieces of real estate. And all of a sudden, you got a big penalty. Ah, that's a pretty easy decision, isn't it? So, and I think that's what happens. And I just, you know, maybe it's unfortunate, and it just puts the burden on you, the taxpayer, to take a position in your return. And obviously it's flagged now, and you're going to say that's not right. And you have the ability to do that, but, you know, obviously nobody likes to fight with the IRS. So, question.
Can you talk a little bit about the reduction of tax attributes? And a typical real estate guy, you know, they've been living on these NOLs for years and years, never paid a dime of federal income taxes. They file Chapter 7, they enjoy the, you know, the bankruptcy exclusion, they discharge $80 million worth of debt, but they can't. There's this dollar-for-dollar reduction in tax attributes, I keep hearing. That means that whatever NOL carry-forward they have, they got reduced by whatever debt is discharged.
Yeah, the question is well, you have this real estate entrepreneur who's been not paying tax for their whole life. Because
which is the standard pattern.
I understand.
even though they live in a $10 million house.
All right, so they take these deductions, which reduces this. The complaint here is I've been taking all these deductions all these life, and now I run this thing through bankruptcy, and it's tax free under Section 108. Is there a free lunch? And the answer is kind of yeah. I mean, yeah, if you have NOLs at the time you are in bankruptcy, whatever NOLs exist right then, whatever basis exists, yeah, it all gets wiped out. So you lose any NOLs, but so what? I mean, like you said, they never paid tax before. But this is why the issue of non-recourse debt versus recourse debt came up in Tufts. Forgetting about bankruptcy, you know, people said, well, if you're writing off real estate deductions, then the sale price should be the debt. So you don't escape that gain, because the gain isn't excludable under Section 108. But if it's recourse debt, there is a kind of a free lunch there in a sense. But they lose everything. There are no more tax attributes. There is no more assets. If they have some exempt assets, they got to reduce the basis of those.
But the tax attributes are only reduced by the amount of debt discharged, right? So if they actually have a larger NOL, now let's say they started out with lots of money and they lost it all in real estate, and the debt that is being discharged is less than their NOLs, they can still keep whatever NOL.
Right. The question is, well, if the debt discharge is less than the NOLs, can they continue on? And the answer is yeah. I mean, the NOLs go into the bankruptcy estate. If they're not used by the bankruptcy estate, they come back out. And then you're just limited by, you know, Section 172 or whatever it is in the Internal Revenue Code that says you carry it back 5 years and forward 15 or whatever it might be. So, any other questions? Well, thank you all for listening to me ramble on. I hope it wasn't too confusing.
And I'm thinking maybe next month, instead of the research, I'm going to get my brother John here, the environmental lawyer. We'll get Tim back, and we'll have Lynn, and we'll talk about tax discharge, vacancy discharge, and environmental discharge. It really confused everybody. Right. Next month, we're going to have our research issues, so please come and learn how to, the tricks from the young guys and our librarian about how to do effective bankruptcy legal research. And then October, Todd and I are going to hopefully have a discussion more than I'm talking at you, like this was just great, about what to do when the bank does not complete the foreclosure process and leaves the debtor sort of holding the bank. Thanks again to Tim. Please come on back next month and post in the outline areas, get your names into Paula for the CLE. Everybody sign up for the CLE. The outline's in the audio, so you can listen to this again or on the website. Thank you again.
Larry's a fortune.